This is the recording of a presentation which I made at the World Congress on Innovation on the 9th of October 2013. The title is Defining Probation Practitioners Beyond Probation Staff, and it needs to be listened to with my PowerPoint, which you will also find next to it, next to the audio recording on this website. At a point where England and Wales are about to transfer huge proportions of offender supervision to the private and third sector, and where France has delegated its pre-sentence reports to non-profit charities, and where most of its social work is actually in practice done by these same charities and not by probation services anymore, it seems appropriate to look at who works with a clear and open mind. History and international comparisons show that there is no obvious property over probation work. This work was originally fulfilled by charity volunteers. It became the job of civil servants paid by the state at very different points in time throughout Europe. In some jurisdictions, police is associated to the state, for instance with intensive probation in England and Wales, or citizens with COSA supervision. In most jurisdictions, the criminal justice system would collapse if it was not for the complementary work done by the third sector. Electronic monitoring is also in various jurisdictions actually implemented by private sector agencies. There is also an increasing number of jurisdictions where there are various forms of judicial interventions in supervision. For instance, problem-solving courts have appeared in the United States in 1989, and they have expanded in this country. They then have been transferred to Canada, Australia, the UK and Belgium. Also, a sentences implementation court has been created in Belgium since 2006, and in continental Europe and in South America, a special judge called in French the juge de l'application des peines, roughly translated as the sentence implementation judge, which I shall call by its French acronym the JAP, and my interpretation is that it's kind of the ancestor of problem solving court. Well, this judge is in charge of release and breach and may also take part in the supervision process. So when you have judicial participation and supervision, well, you also have a host of other practitioners, such as in particular prosecutors and legal clerks or paralegal and attorneys. In this presentation, I shall particularly focus on judges and attorneys. But before I start telling you about the French context, I will first address theoretical issues. So what can possibly be the role of judges and attorneys in probation, and is it an added bonus? Well, this presentation will draw upon the example of the French JAP and of international problem-solving courts, along with various bodies of literature, legitimacy of justice, compliance, judicial rituals, fair trial, human rights, and assistance. It will also draw upon 5 years of research, empirical research, which I have conducted, and this line of research could be labelled Who Works in French Probation. I have first studied probation officers for 2 years, and for 2 years and a half the French Juge de l'Application des Peines, the JAP, then the third sector, in parallel to the JAP actually. I have a PhD student studying prosecutors, and when I was studying JAP from the empirical viewpoint, I also questioned 32 attorneys, and that turned out to be really fascinating. So in the next 2 years I shall conduct a similar empirical study on attorneys in sentences implementation. These studies suggest that the best way forward is to think in terms of complementary work and partnership rather than in terms of turf. They do not suggest, however, that this will be achieved by governments that threaten the very existence of key probation actors, such as in England and Wales, probation services, and in France, not the juge de l'application des peines per se, but at least its judicial appearance and the procedural context in which these judges are actually operating. The plan of the French Ministry of Justice is to eliminate fair trial, virtually eliminate fair trial, in order to fast process offenders out of prison. But let us start with the theoretical part of my presentation. from the theoretical viewpoint, there are a number of reasons why, in my opinion, judicial participation and in release supervision and in dealing with breach is a necessity. In order to defend this point of view, I shall thus draw upon various types of literature. First, the legitimacy of justice literature, following Tyler. Tyler has showed that, according to his summary in the latest book by Crewe and Hucklesby, and all the references appear on my PowerPoint, first, that people want to have a forum in which they can tell their story. That is, they want to have a voice. The first component corresponds exactly to what we call in French the contradictoire, which would be called the adversarial trial in England and Wales, or in the United States or Canada. Contradictoire is actually a better term, in my opinion, than adversarial, and fits better to that kind of trial. Because it's more neutral, less aggressive, it does imply that there is a balance of power during the trial, but it does not necessarily mean that parties are going to, you know, they are at war with each other. That being said, the point here is that in a contradictoire or adversarial trial, the person can express his viewpoint, and here it's the offender we're talking about, or the probationer, that person can be assisted by an attorney. The concept of forum, which also is in that phrase by Tyler said people want to have a forum also, the concept of forum is more complex to implement in a context where, as is the case in France, hearings are held in camera, but still, the principle is here. People need a voice, but they need that voice to be expressed in a context which is can be labelled as being a forum, therefore implies there should be a minimum of decorum. Second point, according to Tyler, people react to evidence that the authorities with whom they are dealing are neutral. Now, this is a little bit new in the empirical literature, or was at the time, but it's not new at all for legal scholars. Not new at all in terms of the history of the penal process, actually. It's been for centuries, as legal scholars have been discussing the principle of impartiality, which is now part of and part and parcel of the European Law Convention and the jurisprudence of the European Human Rights Court. In French law, it's called the separation of functions. And that can only be respected when you have a proper trial. It does not necessarily have to be extremely formal, but you need a minimum of decorum. Again, you need that contradiction. But with impartiality, the important thing is not only that the judge must be de facto impartial, it also means that in the eye of the person who is in contact with the tribunal, in our case again the probationer, but that could be anybody, people divorcing, people dealing with tort cases, well, that person needs to believe that the judge is neutral and impartial. And as the Human Rights Court states, and has stated on numerous occasions, what's important is that the impression that this court gives, and this impression is given not only by the behaviour of the judge, but also by the setting and the procedure that's observed, and has to be a fair trial in all sense of the term. Now, getting back to Tyler, he thoroughly states that people are sensitive to whether they are treated with dignity and politeness, and to whether their rights as citizens are respected. Now, in my opinion, this actually contains two principles. On the one hand, it refers to the usual implications of a fair trial. The rights of citizens are respected, he says. On the other hand, it refers to the attitude which judges have towards people. And it refers to whether the judge behaves with politeness, calls the person by that person's name, respects the person's dignity in all ways, the way he speaks to the person, the way he processes the case and deals with it. So again, this is extremely important, and from what I've observed with the French JAP trials, this is exactly what they do. Tyler lastly states, in part redundantly in my opinion, that people focus on cues that communicate information about the intentions and character of the legal authority with whom they are dealing. Is the court interested in their case, and is it trying to do its best? The analysis of the rulings of the Juge de l'application des peines, the JAP, I had 1,300 of them, and the observation of hearings, I observed hundreds of them, along with the interviews of practitioners, and there again I interviewed 75 of them, which is 20% of the JAP, the French JAP. Now all this showed that these are indeed qualities that most JAP possess. They use a tone which is at times firm, but always problem-solving, at times empathic, and always sets they always set the boundaries, yet it's clear that they care and they are respectful. So this is all in line with what Tyler expresses. So to summarise, what constitutes legitimate justice is thus the combination of fair trial and the ties between a probationer and a judge through his interest for him and his case, but also through the boundaries he sets. One might say that this can be done by a probation officer or prison personnel, but this is not so because we have seen the first two components of Tyler's four bullet list, and these refer to an actual trial. So it's not just about a nice person who cares, it's also about independence in the full sense of impartiality, as I've mentioned before, transparency, defence rights, and formal rituals. Now, there are differences between problem-solving courts and the French JAP, for instance. In problem-solving courts, the judges are supervising themselves. Of course, they are working with a team, which is fantastic, but they are also seeing the offenders on a very regular basis. In the French model, the JAP only intervenes for very, very important moments, key moments, such as release, such as dealing with breach cases, or when they add obligations, because obviously if you add an obligation, you make the probation order stricter, and this obviously requires, or at least in my opinion, a fair trial too. The person should have a chance to discuss the facts and discuss the opportunity of the decision that's about to be made and to be assisted by an attorney. So rituals in the French context, but I think probably more in general, are at least necessary in supervision for key decisions that are made for the probation, about the probationer, and they should be parties to this particular trial, and I'll get back to that notion. So they need rituals, and so second I shall draw on the ritual literature. We have a small body of research. Maruna, in his Reentry as a Rite of Passage, for instance, in Punishment and Society. We have Tate in Sentencing and Society. We have two French authors, Garapon and Deprez. Again, you have all the references on my PowerPoint. They have all insisted on the importance of rituals, and judicial rituals in particular. With regard to reentry and supervision, as Maroon wrote to me in an email, judicial rituals show that your case is considered seriously. It's not an ordinary case. Now, going back to my viewpoints, the way I see it, it is indeed important. If there is a trial, then it means to the person is being actually told through the process, through the defence rights, through the respectful and formal ways, that your case is important, we are respecting you, because we're giving you the full range, or virtually the full range, of what it means to be respectful to a person who meets a judge in trial. A French JAP was telling me that when he did not wear his robe, or at least a cravat during prison release hearing, offenders were offended, and they told him so. Well, you could at least have put a cravat, Mr. Judge. So a ritual is important when a person goes from one state to another, life and death, single, married, student, graduate, free, incarcerated, and offender, desister. Maruna has been talking in his 2011 article, but also in his original book in 2001, about rituals, desistance rituals, and his opinion is that it does reinforce desistance. Third body of literature, compliance research, and this is a really booming body of research. Research into compliance, and they're often linked to the legitimacy of justice literature, have also insisted on rituals and the respect they convey for the person they deal with and their case. There is not yet a huge amount of empirical evidence that judicial rituals support compliance, except if you include the problem-solving court literature. I shall get back to this, but the hunch is pretty strong, and again, if you add the problem-solving court movement and all the evaluations that have been done, which have proved that it's the intervention of a judge that is important, then you have indeed a huge amount of empirical literature. Just to give you an example, and again I've got references on my PowerPoint, a fascinating read in the latest Pamela Ugvudica and Peter Reynolds, What Works in Offender Compliance, just published in 2013, and an absolute must read, by the way. Peter Reynolds has a chapter on compliance interviews in Jersey, where he presents the experiment in New Jersey, it's obviously on the Isle of Jersey. When an offender breaches, he meets a probation officer, if I remember well. It's a little bit formal. He's been asked why he breached, what were the obstacles. So it's very practical and a little bit formal. And this research did show that there was a link with compliance and these interviews. Now, interestingly, these compliance interviews are actually exactly what French juges de l'application des peines do en masse. Now, in my research, virtually 100% of French juges did recadrage, which is the equivalent of compliance interviews. Recadrage would be roughly setting the person straight, or they also call it a reminding of the law. Now, in these procedures, that JAP holds an informal hearing where the person is reminding of the order and his obligations, but it also has time to present the reasons why he did not comply and the obstacles that he is facing. And this hearing also means to sort of guide the offender towards how he can solve, or how he can be helped solving these obstacles. In France, this is done by a judge. What counts here is the ritual in the fair procedure context, in my opinion. Again, a judicial ritual does not mean an extremely formal context of procedure, but it does mean a bit of formality. That fourth body of literature, the desistance literature. Desistance literature and motivational interviewing literature as well have pointed to the need to collaborate with a person, not to do things to the person, but to make things with the person, and they also insist on personal agency. Please refer to the list of references again on my PowerPoint. Now, this of course is essential to probation itself. In the French JAP model, the supervisee, the probationer, has to present a case and defend it in front of the judge. He is therefore, and also in the legal sense of the term, he is an actor, because he's an applicant, so he is a party to his trial. He builds his release plan, or his project, as we prefer to call it, in the form of a project which is the heart of his application. In order to build this project, which explains how he's going to live, how he wants to live, how it's also credible and practical for him to envision his future. In doing so, he has to collaborate with probation services, with the third sector on numerous occasions too, but he also collaborates with his family, with his friends, whoever, but also with his attorney. Attorneys can play a big part in the creation of this release plan. So the hearings are also collaborating in most cases, because they are basing, the questions are also based to a great extent to the project, and the person has to explain why this project is dear to him or her and why he's defending it. Then of course, lastly, talking about empirical literature, you have the problem-solving court movement, which I briefly referred to previously, and again you have a huge body of literature there which has shown that it works really well, and one of the key factors, obviously not the only one, but one of the key factors is the fact that the judge participates in supervision. Now, in the listing literature, I shall now switch to legal literature, which is seldom crossed with empirical criminological literature, but I think it's important to also listen to that side of the story. First, you have human rights issues. Now, indeed, criminologists have, and there is a burgeoning literature pertaining to supervision and human rights. Nelson Gelthorpe, Canton and Eady, Connolly and Ward. These authors have studied this from the criminological viewpoint. Respectfully, I don't think they've gotten the full picture, because they're not lawyers, and it would be interesting to merge this thinking with legal literature, because a lot has been published in the legal literature. Lawyers have long studied this from the legal viewpoint, from the human rights issues viewpoint first. In terms of human rights, it's true that so far the European Human Rights Convention has never said, nor has the court, that Article 5 applied to release, for instance. And then you have the Van Zyl Smit and Spencer chapter in the Patfield Van Zyl Smit and Junkel Release from Prison book, which was published by Willem in 2010. So, for a summary of the European jurisprudence, please refer to this chapter. But the European Human Rights Court has decided in some cases that Article 6 should apply to sanctions affecting the length of the sentence, as with remission and withdrawal, and also with decisions made for LIFER, and this time based on Article 5. Again, refer to Randall Smith. And a series of lawyers are actually advocating incorporating fair trial in release, supervision and breach cases. I have done that as early as 1994 in my PhD thesis, and it's actually been implemented in France a few years afterwards. Nicola Patfield has made her opinion quite clear on this subject. She's published with Morgan and Maguire in the latest Oxford Handbook of Criminology edition, and also on her own in various articles. Human rights issues refer, for instance, to the problem that parole boards present. They are not independent from the executive, contrary to the court. Again, Nicola Patfield, The Future of Parole in Archibald News, or Rona Epstein, The Parole Board Found Not Sufficiently Independent in Criminal Law and Justice Weekly. So, if a parole board is not independent, what about a prison governor or probation service making decisions in these matters? I think it's even more problematic. There is a serious problem with independence, and as far as I'm concerned, there's also a risk of prisonisation of the decisions themselves. I mean, if you study, which I did in my PhD in 1994, for instance, if you study how Jappe used to decide before they were to respect fair trial, the case at the time of my PhD, well, they operated within the prison walls in a commission. They never saw the offender. There was no appeal, no fair trial at all, and they were surrounded by prison officers and prison governors and all that, and the decisions were mostly based at the time on the behaviour of the person in jail, which is completely irrelevant, essentially irrelevant. Much more interesting it is, you know, the release plan concept and the collaboration with the offender, as I described above. So also the factors that were on which the decisions were based were completely wrong. So this is also what happens. In any case, even if the European Human Rights Court has not so far stated that courts should or states should apply fair trial for these important decisions I was referring to about before, it does not mean that it won't be the case in the future, because the particularity of a European Human Rights Court jurisprudence is that it is never static. It changes, and it changes because it follows what prevails in Europe. So the more jurisdictions that will respect fair trial, the more chances are that the European Human Rights Court will follow them. In other words, European jurisdictions should not necessarily be human rights followers. They could be at the forefront, they could be leaders. Unfortunately, French seems to be going backwards, like I said before. We will probably, if the current government has its way in this department, go back to the previous era where there was no fair trial at all. Now, moving on, and still with legal reasoning, this, of course, could take me very far, and I will not be too long on this, but it's very important, obviously. Those who don't believe that a court should decide in these matters tend to say, well, this belongs to the executive. Once the sentence is passed, it should not be for the courts to continue making decisions. This should be for the executive. And when I made this presentation at the World Congress, a Kenyan delegate mentioned that this actually was based on the principle of the separation of power. Well, in my opinion, and I made that opinion clear in my PhD thesis and other publications of mine, and this is how things are perceived today by most French legal scholars, I think the same would be said in Germany. Well, precisely, once the sentence has been passed, shortening that sentence or transforming its length, for instance, with remission, but the same applies with parole, with home detention curfew schemes and that kind of thing. Our perception of things is that because a court of law has decided on the normal length of the sentence, only a court of law should change that length. Of course, it's probably different in jurisdictions like England and Wales, where the sentence itself is perceived as having two parts, a punitive part, and then another part where you can then release the person and think about the future. But this is not how we see things in France. We see that the sentence has been static on the day it's been pronounced, but then has been changing, constantly changing according to the change of circumstances, the person's behaviour, the person's now new future, because the person's just passed a diploma in prison, the job the person may have found, or the shelter in which that person's going to be released, etc. So these are changes in circumstances according to French legal literature, and these authorise the courts to release the person, because the sentence has now to be adapted. And this is why we call it sentences implementation courts. The court, we also call them sentence management decisions. Management really refers to the fact that the sentence, again, is only static on the day it's pronounced, but once it's passed, what happens next is management. This management should be the decisions of the courts, because, again, it's going to transform the sentence. But this is not the only reason. Think about, for instance, a recall decision. The person will return to prison. This is a huge liberty issue. There are numerous other reasons why legal scholars, and I in particular, because it's been really a strong part of my work throughout the last 20 years, why we think, and why I think in particular, that we need a court decision for release, for breach, and for adding obligations. Because once you have a court decision, then you have a series of legal consequences that are attached to the very fact that it's a court that makes the decisions. First, the person gets a second chance, because it always means an appeal is possible. Second chance for the person to get it right, but also second chance for the country, the jurisdiction, to get the case dealt with properly and to get the case dealt with according to the law. Now, of course, we are in a written law jurisdiction, which means we attach great importance to the strict or at least respectful application of the law, and it's our way of controlling the discretionary power of courts. They have discretionary power, probably more so than in other jurisdictions, but this is only because the law goes into great details and it's got to be implemented by courts themselves on the one hand, and on the other hand, there's always the risk of appeal, and the appellate courts will control how this power has been exercised. So it means you also have a local, regional jurisprudence that applies to all the local courts. And then, of course, if you have appeal, then you can also challenge the Court of Appeals decisions by applying to the our equivalent of the Supreme Court, which is the Court of Cassation. And the importance, the Court of Cassation is hugely important, because it will state this is how the rules should be implemented in such and such a case, and then it becomes enforceable in every single jurisdiction in France. Which means you cannot have 100 probation services or 100 probation JAPs deciding differently in such cases. All this, which is quite constraining, means justice is more legitimate, because applicants know they can challenge decision, know they've got a chance, again, of getting it right and of the law being implemented correctly, and they also know that the law is the same for everybody, whether you're an offender, whether you're the President of the Republic. Another important feature of fair trial is that the decision maker has to justify his decision by writing a ruling. Now, in France, we don't have 60 pages ruling, 30 pages rulings. JAP rulings are typically 5 to 6 pages, and they're quite standardised, actually, but there's a few paragraphs that are specifically about the case. It's very important, because thus the probationer gets to know exactly why the decision was made to add an obligation, why he was breached, why he was released or not released. And then, if it was not released, he can change his release plan, because perhaps it was said that there was something wrong with his release plan and he should address it. So it's much more pedagogical and more legitimate, because the judge cannot just decide on a whim and decide, oh, I won't do it, I just don't feel like it. No, it's been explained, and he has to painstakingly explain according to the facts, according to everybody that the judge has heard, all the documents he's read, all these have got to be mentioned in the ruling, and then he's got to explain according to the law, he's got to quote the exact rules that he's been applying to the case. Now, with sanctions, lastly, there is the issue of the presumption of innocence, which is hardly ever addressed in the criminological literature and rarely in the legal literature. This is something I have never read anywhere in the literature, well, apart from my own publications. For a lawyer, it's however obvious. The probation services says a person did not attend a meeting, arrived late, does not get treatment, was insulting or violent to someone in the service. Why shouldn't normal burden of the proof apply to these assertions? After all, the consequence is imprisonment, or can be imprisonment. Surely the burden of the proof should be as high as it is when a court sentences someone to initial imprisonment. In most instances, of course, there is no disputing the fact. But it does happen sometimes. I'll give you two examples. First, during a hearing I attended, I saw this chap had been accused of assaulting another person at a charity-based French equivalent of a hostel or approved premise. The charity had decided without any trial or proof to send him away. The judge had no choice but to send him to prison as he was out on a release measure attached to the hostel. As the law requests, within 8 days a hearing was organized, and there his attorney made use of the adversarial context and proved that there was serious doubt about his client's guilt. The judge had to release him again, and actually was quite convinced by the attorney's very pugnacious demonstration. Also, even the prosecutor had to say, well, yes, there is serious doubt in this case, therefore I will actually approve if you decided to release that person again. In another case, the probation officer had sent a report to the JAP stating that the offender's alleged hiring letter must have been fraudulent because she had not found the firm online, but she had not consulted the appropriate national registration database. The attorney contested the report and proved that the firm did exist and the person was released. So these are two examples, but I could quote numerous examples where, thanks to the attorney, the person got it right, and somebody had done something wrong, somebody had misinterpreted the facts, or there was another way of seeing the facts, because there's not just one truth, and that's what every judge will tell you. There are usually several truths, and it's the judge that decides which one, or the balance of which ones, he's going to rule in favour of. Now, what can a judge actually do, and what should a judge actually do? There are several extremes if you study the various jurisdictions. For instance, in England and Wales, you'll have the probation service making some of the decisions I referred to before, and the parole boards making other decisions in other cases. In the case of the problem-solving court movement, it's the other extreme. Not only the important decisions, but also part of supervision is actually done by the judge him or herself. France lies in between, somewhere in the middle, with only the more important decisions being made by the judge, but it's actually for the probation services to supervise the person, and in practice to the third sector to do the social work. So we have this. Overall, it's a bit more complicated, but overall, this is how things are done in France. In Belgium, for instance, the three JAP tribunal releases offenders serving sentences of more than 3 years, but for sentences that are less than 3 years, it's actually the prison governor that decides to release the person. So you have all sorts of different possibilities. French JAP can make a lot of decisions, and you can see that on my PowerPoint. He can release inmates, he can grant inmates furlough and remission, he can transform a custody sentence of up to 2 years, 1 year if they're recidivists, into various community sentences or measure before they are executed, might change in the future, mind you, and be reduced down to 1 year for first-time offenders and 6 months for recidivists, which would be a pity. The JAP can also deal with or sanction breach, and he's got a variety of sanctions like problem-solving courts. He can define and modify people serving community sentences or measures obligations. He can expunge criminal records for released offenders if they need it to find employment. He is informed of incidents and breach and can ask the probation services to write reports or do investigations, and can even ask the police or gendarmes sometimes. He may also notify offenders their obligations in order to create some kind of a ritual to make sure the person really understands well. If it's formal, well, at least that's what most practitioners think, the person will remember his obligations better. And what about attorneys? Now, as we've seen, they can be absolutely vital with breach cases. They are also very useful with release applications. The research I conducted on JAP and which I intend to continue because I need to check what I found more systematically, that you will you'll immediately see the possibilities and research avenue, and it also will probably ring quite a lot of bells. I found that there was a classification that could probably be made between two types of attorneys. The first I call the classic penal attorneys. They represented by far the majority of the 32 attorneys I interviewed. In percentage, it was 87.5%. Their knowledge of sentences implementation varied considerably, I mean the legal aspect of it, of course. Some were very well trained, others were completely ignorant, but the majority fitted in an intermediary grey area. Their knowledge and commitment with the file followed a similar pattern. But they had a rather limited knowledge of the judicial process. Now, they also hold traditional views on what their professional obligations should be. They tended to consider that their role was just to advise in the case or the file, and in our domain it meant to tell the offender which measure, conditional release, electronic monitoring, semi-freedom, other, would stand a better chance to be accepted by the judge who was apprised of their case. They thought their role was also to coach their client how to best behave during the hearing, to convince him or her that he or she had to bring the documented proofs that the judge demanded. As of the latter, they did not seek those documents themselves, but for those held at the judge's office, of course, which they could access, they expected the client to provide all these things on his own. If he did not, well, it was their loss, not theirs. On the day of the hearing, their plea can be rather devoid of passion, to be honest, and descriptive, and sometimes insignificant even. It's swift and adds little, if anything, to the understanding of the case. But some are actually very good. Some are very good lawyers, and they can argue, they can have very interesting legal reasoning, or as in the case I described before, the attorneys who was rather pugnacious, well, this is traditional penal trial, sentencing trial posture, so they can do properly when the time comes, of course. These attorneys don't seem to be very passionate about these particular cases, though. But again, some are very good, some are very bad, some are in between. A significant minority, so 12.5%, were what I called holistic attorneys. They saw their job through radically different lenses, in the same line as the American comprehensive law or therapeutic jurisprudence movements, both linked to a school of thought which tries to humanize justice, its impact on citizens and outcome. They reinvented their craft. These attorneys seem to be more frequently than their more classic peers, happy and even radiant, and even though they do face the same financial and material ordeals, they never mention them. The first difference with their colleague is that they start preparing release or sentence management from the very beginning, and usually as soon as the sentence is passed, even for a long sentence. They already start at that point in time advising, coaching and preparing their clients to their future in the community and for their release plan. This means that they might continue advising their clients in some cases for a great number of years. They also work in partnership with their clients' families, and they coach and advise their family too. In some cases, have struck by with their incredible deep knowledge of the family history, the circumstances, the psychological balance, and the links and the ties of the different people in the family. And they knew this by far much better than probation officers. Probation officers in France are so overloaded they do not have time to go into family ties and to meet with a family and all that. They do not work with families at all. So these attorneys meet family members regularly, they gather documents, they meet their clients in the attorney's visitation room of the prison, and sometimes they drive hundreds of miles in order to do so, and thus become TGV, high-speed trains, or planes, regular passengers. They also get in contact with the probation services, with the JAP, with the prosecutor, with charities and the third sector agencies, with Job Centre Plus, with administrations, and so on. They do not hesitate to pester these agencies and these people and their staff, and they would not take no for an answer, as I have been the witness of, nor let these practitioners ignore their requests for documents and other information. In short, they spend months, they spend years preparing the offender's release project in collaboration with him, with his family, with their loved ones and with relevant agencies. Because they know their client and his circumstances to a T, they would be sure to draft a perfectly credible tailored release plan for him and his family. They never bow down to their clients or family's unrealistic schemes or plans, but they would au contraire, with time and collaborative coaching, firmly yet with care and support, lead them to the right application. No, this measure is not for you, or if you embark on such a project, I can guarantee you that it will be rejected. So they think in terms of ultimate goals, they think in terms of resistance, and they've got quite good knowledge of it, by the way. They think in terms of future reinsertion. They do not just think in terms of winning a case, by far. In other words, they are what the French legal literature calls justice auxiliaries. Now, that's how we call our attorneys. And they are truly, in the noble sense of the term, justice auxiliaries. They are part of the probation process, of the release process, and perhaps even of the desistance process, but that would have to be investigated, of course. So to conclude, as one of these holistic attorneys put it, I take great pleasure in emptying the sea with a teaspoon. Thank you.